Turn your radio on.
This is a download from Triple J.
Australia's national youth network. On radio,
on TV,
and online.
For more music, current affairs, comedy, and culture,
triplej.net.au.
And now...
Good morning, Dr. Carl.
Good morning, Dr. Zan. How are you today?
Very well. Very excited about getting into a lot of questions. We've got a big board here. You want to just dive straight in?
In.
Okay. We'll remind you that if you do have a question for Dr. Carl and you've never called before, 1-300-055-36 is the number to buzz us on. If you've got an answer and you can't get through, you can contact Carl direct on Twitter. DOCTORKARL is how to find him on Twitter, or post your answers on the Triple J forum on the J website, or text us 1975-7555. Let's go to it. Simon's calling in from Quakers Hill. Hi, Simon.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What's your question?
I'm just wondering, these new 3D TVs, they say you have to have special glasses, but I was always under the impression that your eyes do the work.
Yes. And the experiment that you can do is to make two periscopes. You know, periscope with two mirrors, a bit of cardboard?
Yep.
Make two periscopes, each one about a metre long, and turn them sideways. And then suddenly your eyeballs, instead of being 10 centimetres apart, are 2 metres apart. And you'll see a seagull, and man, the 3D effect is just amazing. So what you're looking at is a TV, which is of itself three-dimensional, but the image is just a flat image on a screen, and it's taken with a single camera. And there's no way you can get 3D. So what you've got to do is feed one image to your left eyeball and then a different image to your right eyeball. In reality, this happens all the time. On a TV, the way they make it work is they feed one image to the left eyeball and then one image to the right eyeball if you've got the special glasses that go flick, flick, left, right, left, right. If you've got the polarizing type, then you see them both happening all the time. But you've got to, the point is you've got to feed two slightly different images to each eyeball. Or, in the case of a pigeon, as they walk backwards and forwards, as they shove their head backwards and forwards as they're walking, one eyeball is looking at you and it takes one snapshot now, and a fraction of a second, it takes another snapshot from a different position, and then the two images from the one eyeball have got slightly different points of view, and then the bird can say, ah, I can see Simon, he's 3 metres away, that's not a threat.
Yeah. Now, I think they had 3D, a couple of years ago, but these new TVs have special glasses, not just the red and blue.
Well, the red and blue was to make sure that you were seeing different images to each eye. But the trouble was it meant that you end up with a black and white image. Now what they've got is, I think, polarizing is one way of doing it. So you remember, you know, polarizing glasses? If you get polarizing glasses, borrow them from a friend, and then put them in front of the screen of your phone. And as you turn it around, you'll see at one angle, it goes black. And that's the sort of effect they're working on. So that means the left eye will see one image and the right eye will see another image, and the TV is broadcasting left eye, right eye, left eye, right eye, left eye, right eye, and changing the polarisation as it's doing it.
Oh, okay.
Makes sense, Simon?
Yep, makes lots of sense.
Thanks for the call, mate. Take it easy.
Bye.
Ben's calling in from the Sunshine Coast. Hi, Ben.
G'day, Dr. Carl, Dr. Jan.
Good morning, Dr. Ben.
I was just wondering, I go to the beach quite a lot, and I notice all the shells on the sand. My question is, where do they come from, and how long does it take a shell to grow?
Oh, this is actually interesting. There's a thing called the carbonate crisis. Shells are made from carbon and oxygen and calcium, and it turns out that as we dump more carbon dioxide into the ocean, we make the oceans more acid, and you know there's different levels in the oceans where it's more acid, less acid, and we're heading for what's called a carbonate crisis. Look that up. So what they do is they get calcium and they make something solid on the outside. We make calcium on the inside. We have an endoskeleton. They have an exoskeleton. Now, I don't know the specific organs from which they extrude this shell that they have on the outside. In our case, what we do is we lay down this cartilage and then we calcify the cartilage. I don't know how shells do it. And if a marine person could ring in, I'd be very grateful.
A marine biologist, do you
marine
think?
Biologist,
all right,
yes.
We'll see if we can find out more for you, Ben. Thanks for the call.
Thank you, Dr. Ben.
Very much.
See you later. Rodney's calling in from Woodend. Hi, Rodney.
Hello.
Very beautiful part of Victoria you find yourself in.
Yes, beautiful area.
It is. What's your question for Dr. Carl?
Okay, I've got a question. Let's just say we start colonising new planets and humans, say, move to a planet that only has a 20-hour day or move to a planet that has a 30-hour day. How would we sort of adjust our clocks without our proper 8-hour sleep cycles and that sort of thing? What sort of effect would it have on us?
With regard to Mars, it's only about half an hour different from us. And quite a few of the scientists have got two watches that they wear, one on Earth time and the other one on Mars time. And gradually, and because they're following the experiments, the rovers that we have still going on Mars, they're with it, and they just live on Mars time. So gradually they drift out at half an hour every day and then drift back in again. With regard to humans, the Earth rotates once every 24 hours, kind of, and our natural clock seems to be 25 hours. So if you get, I think it's either 25 or 23, I think it's 25. If you get some humans and put them in a cave away from, and just let them run their own life cycle, they'll end up with a thing where they live on 25 hours and they'll have a sleep in the morning and a sleep in the afternoon. So you need a bit of attention. So I think there's a little bit of slack in the system, and you could adjust to anything from, say, a 23 to a 27-hour day. Once you start going, say, to a 15-hour day or a 40-hour day, I think that would cause a fair bit of problems, but people would adjust. We are remarkably adjustable to it. If you look back of the records of people who lived before we had electric light, before the Industrial Revolution, in fact, when people lived on farms, people would go back, would go to bed as the sun went down. They'd then, the parents, wake up at around midnight, and I've read descriptions where the man would have a pipe of tobacco and have conjugal relations with his wife, unquote. And so what we think, and they would sleep 12 hours. And all of us are sleep deprived. So many of us wake up only because the alarm clock wakes us up. So if you think, we're already sleep deprived, what difference does it matter if we go to another planet and float around with little wings and be like avatars or whatever on a different clock?
This is one of the great things about camping too, isn't it? Often when you go camping, you haven't got TV, you haven't got any electric light, and you pretty much just start getting pretty tired by about 7 p.m. because the sun's gone down.
And that's because of what your body wants to do. Yeah. Sleep is better than sex. For the next election, look, Zan, I knew I blew it with the last election. How about you and I form the sleep is better than sex party, and that's our sole platform. Forget all this climate change stuff.
Thanks for the call, Rodney.
Okay.
Good on you, mate. See you later. John's calling in from Stanmore. Hi, John.
How are you going? It's Jason, actually.
Oh, sorry, Jason. What's your question for Dr. Carl?
I've got a question about eyeballs. We've just had our third child just recently, and it got us looking at the children's eyeballs. And the story that a child's eyeballs are the same size from the time they're born till we actually grow up. So do we actually grow into our eyes as such?
Ah, look, very good question. I've heard that. I've accepted it. I don't think it's strictly true. I think that our eyes would be probably somewhere between 80 to 90% of the final diameter when you're born. And babies' eyes are really big compared to their skull. And we humans are wired up so that we think that babies are cute because they've got the big eyes and the small nose. And it's an old psychology experiment, show people a bunch of photos, make the eyes a little bit bigger, the nose a bit smaller, hey, they're really attractive, they're really cute. The back of the eye, the retina, is actually part of the brain. There's a direct connection of nerves from the brain inside your skull up the optic nerve into the retina. So the retina is part of your brain, even though it's out, sort of technically speaking outside your skull. I'm guessing that I need to get an ophthalmologist to tell us the exact answer. I'm thinking 80%. I don't think it'd be fully grown, but I think it'd be pretty close
to. Pretty close. All right, we'll see if any ophthalmologists are listening and can give us a call or text or tweet or leave a message on the forum, the many ways you can contact us. Thanks for the call, Jason. We'll see if we can get an answer for you.
Thanks for that.
Ron, you're a Year 12 chemistry student calling in from Perth.
Yes, that's correct.
And what is your question for Dr. Carl?
My question is, I know that the pH of blood is kept constant, and how is this? How can it be kept constant?
That's basically a 3-month physiology course in acid-base balance.
Well, simply how... Sorry.
It's not simple, but you're looking at the kidneys and the lungs both being involved. And just remember that carbon dioxide plus water gives you H2CO3, carbonic acid.
Yeah.
And then you can go backwards to the carbon dioxide and water, or you can go the other way to bicarbonate. And then there's different ways to add or mop up bicarbonate. I used to know it. I've forgotten it. I'd try and get a tame physiologist. It's not simple. It's the thing that everybody hates. And all my anaesthetist mates hate it as well, simply because it's so complicated. I have not got a simple explanation. Hopefully somebody will be able to point you to a good one via our Twitter homepage.
All right, keep an eye on it. Thanks for the call, Ron.
Thank you very much.
Sorry,
see you
Ron.
Later.
That's okay.
Sharon's calling in from the Sunshine Coast today. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. What's your question?
We're just a bit concerned about the bat droppings that we get on our roof at night time. We're on tank water. We do boil our water, and I've told my children not to open their mouth in the shower. But we just don't know if we're being a bit overboard at the moment, especially where where a bat flies from where this latest Hendra outbreak was. But we know it's not the Hendra that's going to be infected in our water tank, but we just don't know what's happening, if you know what I mean.
So are bat droppings potentially dangerous if it seeps into the water tanks,
yeah.
Dr. Carl?
Straight answer is I don't know. And the way to find out the answer to that would be to ring your local teaching hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So where are you? In
Sunshine Coast.
On the Sunshine Coast, yeah.
What you want is a university that has associated with it a medical school.
Yes, the University of the Sunshine Coast has got some medical stuff down there, yeah.
Right. Ask to speak to somebody in infectious diseases. Mm-hmm. And the specific question you want to know is there any infectivity from bat droppings to you? In the case of the Hendra virus, it belongs to a family called Henipa, H-E-N-I-P-A virus, and there's the Hendra virus and the Nipah, N-I-P-A-H virus, and they're both able to cause bad things to people, and the Nipah virus certainly can jump from person to person. The question is, so it's not the bat itself, but it's the virus infecting the bat, and the question is there enough virus in the bat dropping able to infect you? And I don't have a simple answer for that. But infectious diseases officer would be able to help you. That's all they do, that sort of stuff.
All right, maybe check in with the local infectious disease officer in the Sunshine Coast. Thanks for the call, Sharon.
Thank you very much.
See you later. And good on you for using a water tank as well. Jeff's also calling in from the Sunshine Coast. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, guys. How are you going?
Good. What's your question?
Why is it when I go to a physics lecture, I can retain very, very sporadic bits of information, but then when I go to like the tutor the next day, I don't retain the information at all. How do you remember this kind of stuff?
Hang on, so you're having trouble remembering. You can remember it after the lecture, is that right?
Yeah, but you go to a physics lecture and then you try and concentrate so hard on remembering something, and then you go to the next day to the tutor and you totally forget it, but you might remember something completely random, like the colour of the tutor's pen or something.
Yes. Memory is hard. Most of us do not train our memory in the same way that most of us are not trained athletes. In the early days, my father and grandfather had to learn law without textbooks. In Roman times, all law had to be committed to memory. Nowadays, most people do not know their own phone number, right? It's as simple as doing memory courses. There's a whole bunch of memory courses available. I think the best thing to do would be to walk over to psychology and ask them how you'd go about training your memory in the same way that you can get part of the way to having a physique like Arnold Schwarzenegger used to have. You can get a lot of the way towards having a better memory.
So can you think about memory as a muscle that can be,
can be trained.
Can be built up?
Yes, it can be trained. And the guy we had on our first series of Sleek Geeks thought that he had a bad memory, and he did have a bad memory. And so he bought one of these memory training books, which he spoke to the psychology department, asked them for advice, and he became one of the top memory people in the world in the top 100. And you ask him for the 42nd thousandth place of pi, he can do it to you. You introduce him to 100 people and ask them what their favourite colour is, their favourite number, their job, their first name, and the colour of the hair. And then you can say, say to him, "What? How many redheaded people liked green as their first colour and were women?" And he'd say three. Oh, that'd be Sharon, Raynell, and Alexandra. And you can be trained for it. Do not feel bad about it. Now, but one other hint for you, Jeff. You listen carefully.
Yeah.
You always do study on the lecture at some stage. The only time in my life that I consistently got distinctions and high distinctions was when I did that hour of study before I went into the lecture.
Okay.
Just shift the whole thing forward by one day and you can lift yourself up from a pass to a distinction or from a credit to a high distinction. It's amazing. Do that and the memory tricks that the psychology people will tell you and you can get a better memory. Do not think that it cannot be trained. It can be trained.
Thanks for the call, Jeff.
Thank you.
Yeah. I've got to do some of that memory training as well. I retain a whole bunch of useless information. Josh is calling in from Ballarat this morning. Hi, Josh.
G'day, how you going?
Good. What's your question?
I just had a question why people end up, who drink excessive amounts of alcohol, end up with red noses.
Ah, the technical term for that is rhinophyma, R-H-I-N-O-P-H-Y-M-A. And it seems to be related to the sebaceous glands growing too much. Now, we don't exactly know why. What we can do is we can get a history from the person that they've been drinking lots of alcohol. We can look at their nose and see that it's red. We can then go looking carefully and, if necessary, do little slices. You don't do it to the nose, but, you know, after they're dead, all that sort of stuff. And you can say, yep, the sebaceous glands are growing too fast. The link between the alcohol and the growth, we don't know. But we know that one causes the other. There's various treatments. You can just physically slice it off. Ooh. Or you can, you know, kill it with a laser or something like that. But that's the link.
Thanks for the call, Josh.
Thank you. Bye.
See you later. Luke's calling in from Hobart. You're about to board a plane tonight, though, Luke. Where are you headed?
Off to Melbourne to see the Nitro Circus with the mates and that.
The what circus?
The Nitro Circus with Travis Estrada.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And what's your science question related to this flight?
Well, actually, just going up on the plane and that, as we always take off, my ears, like, really, really hurt that bad. And I was just wondering if it's the same sort of scenario as when you're diving, would you have to equalise, like hold your nose and try and blow through to burst your ears, and just how do you go to prevent it?
Yes, there is a problem there with the middle, with the canal leading from the back of your throat up until your middle ear, where the eardrum is. So you can get to your eardrum from two sides, either one with a cotton bud from the outside, don't do that, number two, coming up from the inside. And a skilled ENT person can slide a pipe and go looking at it. What's happened is that is it happening on one side or both sides?
Both sides.
Okay. So it's probably not due to a trauma or injury. It might have been due to infection on both sides. So you might have scarring on both sides that keeps that pipe, the eustachian tube or the inner auditory tube, blocked. Or it could be immature neuromuscular innervation. In other words, you've got this tube, it's surrounded by flesh, and either the muscles or the nerves or both have not fully matured to make them open up. And this can happen. For example, in my case, I had a tooth that was supposed to come out of my head when I was 7 and didn't come out until I was 30-something. So if you're really worried about it, you can then get your GP to bounce you to an ENT, ear, nose and throat doctor, who will then slide a pipe up and say, there's nothing wrong, I can't see any scarring, it's probably just immature nerves. Or they can say, oh, you had a bad infection, look, mate, it's all scarred, you poor bugger.
Well, fair enough.
Check it out.
Thanks for the call, Luke. Enjoy your time in Melbourne.
See
you later, mate. 1300 055 36. If you've got a question for us, as Tristan does in Ferntree Gully. Thanks for staying on the line, Tristan. What's your question?
That's okay. Morning, doctors.
Good morning.
Good morning, Dr. Christian.
My question's about milk, and I've got a how good is milk after pasteurisation? Like, it kills all the bacteria in the milk, and I was wondering how good that is in the milk.
Pasteurisation is named after Louis Pasteur, and it's a process to heat the milk. And you heat it, you sort of flash heat it, and then immediately cool it down again so it doesn't change it too much. And on one hand, you have altered some of the fats, the proteins, the carbohydrates in there, and you're getting a different flavour. That's for sure. And people say, oh, it's not the same, and they're right. On the other hand, you have killed the bacteria inside. There's brucellosis, TB, a whole bunch of other diseases that can be caused by drinking raw milk if those bacteria happen to be in the flock, which sometimes they are. So, yes, it does change it. Does it take away a lot of nutrition? Not a lot. Does it take away some of the taste? Yes. Is it safer? Yes.
Okay.
Thanks.
Is there a difference between UHT milk and other types of milk that are boiled at different temperatures then?
Ah, then there's the whole thing of the different regimes. With the UHT milk, you crank it up to quite a high temperature and leave it there for a while, and that doesn't really taste like regular milk. It's sort of whitish, and once again, you've lost quite a lot of the flavour, but it will survive, as you know, without refrigeration for quite a while. It is a different heating regime. I can't remember off the top of my head what the heating regime is. I'm sorry.
Thanks for the call, Tristan.
Thank you, Dr. Tristan.
See you later. Matthew's calling in from Hobart today. Hi, Matthew.
Oh, g'day. How are you?
Good. What's your question?
My question for Dr. Carl is, why does electroconvulsive therapy work?
Oh, nobody knows. Does it work? Yes. When I was a medical student, I was right against it. I'd seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest where ECT was used as a punishment. And I'd read those books by the New Zealand author Janet Frame, F-R-A-M-E.
Mm.
And she, in the 1940s and 50s, spent 8 years in a series of psychiatric hospitals and was given some 200 sessions of ECT as a punishment. Not for making her better, and without anaesthetic and without muscle relaxants. That's just straight torture. But ECT, I was so surprised when I'd go there as a medical patient and I was there helping. The patients were already booked in for ECT, and I tried as a junior doctor, as a medical student, to talk them out of it. I said, why are you getting it? And they kept on saying, because it makes me better. And here were people who didn't respond to any of the medications or other treatments for depression who would do things like sit around the house and just let the dirt pile up around them, or when they got enough energy together would try to commit suicide, and so they'd oscillate between one and the other, and they'd say, it makes me feel better. And yeah. When it's done, and it's even done today with a patient under a general anaesthetic and a muscle relaxant, and they give them 6 to 12 doses of this stuff, you know, 3 per week, about 85% of depressed patients report marked improvement. There are side effects. Everything's got side effects. There's headaches, there's muscle aches, there's confusion, there's nausea. One thing that the patients did say, look, I really don't mind the other stuff, but I don't like the memory loss. You know, so they'll miss out stuff for a few weeks or months before the ECT. There'll be gaps in their memory. They say, but honestly, I prefer it because I can live at home and be part of the family. It's not perfect.
So we don't know scientifically why it works, but you think it does work, Dr. Carl. That's the basis.
Only by talking to the patients.
Mm. All right. Thanks for the call, Matthew.
Yeah, no worries.
And I'll try to talk them out of it. They talk me into it.
Esther's from Morwell and giving us a call with your science question. Hi, Esther.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
I've got a question regarding phosphate. I read a report recently that reported that phosphate in soft drinks could cause aging of the skin. I take a multivitamin tablet that's got 14 milligrams of potassium as phosphate and 10 milligrams of magnesium as phosphate, and I'm wondering whether I'm actually aging my skin by doing that.
Where did you read this report? In a peer-reviewed science journal or in a women's magazine or on the web?
Actually, it was quite funny. My husband read it in the newspaper and brought it home because I'm 41 this year and most people think I'm around 26, and so he was quite concerned that I might actually, you know, start to look like I'm ageing myself if I keep taking this multivitamin B complex tablet.
Okay, and then, look, I haven't read the report at all, so I don't know about it. The only thing I know about phosphates is that in large quantities, they act as their true role, which is a metabolite. A metabolite, in fact, involved in bone metabolism. Mm-hmm. And there are these cases of young women in Texas, in the southern parts of the United States, who drink so much diet colas, and there's a few different brands, yep. They're talking about 4 or 5 or 10 a day, that they've got advanced osteoporosis.
Oh, my goodness.
And these 16-year-old girls have the same degree of osteoporosis that their 70-year-old grandmothers have.
Wow. Wow.
Now, off the top of my head, I don't know what dose of phosphate is necessary to cause this.
Okay.
But if you're really worried, what I'd do is go and see a local doctor and then get bounced to a nutritionist because they know all that stuff. Medical people do 8 hours of nutrition in their whole 5-year course. A nutritionist spends 4 years. They're the people who know.
Oh, okay. Big difference.
Mm.
Oh, well, you can't know everything, you know, but you know where to bounce people.
Thanks for the call, Esther.
Thanks so much. Have a good day.
You too.
Thank you, Dr. Esther.
Steve's calling in from Wollongong. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Dr. Zan. Dr. Carl, how are you going?
Dr. Steve, very well. Steve. What's your question?
Well, when I was in my late teens, I got warts on my feet, and I tried everything. I got them frozen off and tried the things from the chemist to get them off, and nothing worked. And when I was an apprentice, I had a tradesman tell me to urinate on my warts when I was in the shower, and I thought it was stupid. And after a while, I started doing it, and it actually removed the warts from my feet.
Mm.
And well, I was just, yeah, sorry, go.
Well, you're right. Look, warts are weird. They're caused by a virus called HPV, standing for human papillomavirus. Mm. There's about, I don't know, 30, 40 different types that we know of at the moment. Two of them, and I think they're in the teens, maybe 15 or 17 or something like that, are involved with cervical cancer. Warts have always had this weird reputation of somehow being susceptible to external agents. And so there's this history of people who, in less informed times, would be the healer in the village and say, "Well, young Steve, you're worried about that wart. I'll buy it off you. Here, my boy, take a farthing." And you'd take the coin off them and blow me down, the wart would go away. Or people would kiss it, or they'd put saliva on it, or a whole bunch of irrational things that would work for some people and not others, and somehow your immune system would kick into action and get rid of it.
Yeah.
And whether it was chemicals in the urine or just the act that you believe that it would work, we don't know. But there's a long history with regard to warts of them just going away when people get convinced that they'll go away.
Yeah. I was going to ask, would it work for other, if you urinated on other things like dermatitis and stuff like that, would it work as well?
Warts, the wart virus seems to be, susceptible to what our immune system is doing.
Yeah.
Other things such as dermatitis are not.
No.
Not as much. A little bit, yeah, but not as much.
I do like how you want to self-heal, though, Steve. I think that's very good, very sustainable of you.
I didn't when I first heard of it, and then I thought, no, I'll give it a shot. It's only in the shower, and it worked, so.
Mate, if it worked, be very grateful.
I had it work
for me once by making it go away because I was a drug-crazed hippie and I thought it would. The next time I was a medical student and I wanted it to go away and it wouldn't, so I had to go for the liquid nitrogen. Oh, God, that hurts.
Yeah, all right, thanks.
I tried that and it come back worse, actually.
Yes, that also happens as well.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Thanks for the call, Steve.
No worries. Thanks, guys.
See you later, mate.
Now, we've got two answers here, Zan.
Mm-hmm.
With regard to UHT, C. LeBourne tells us that UHT milk is heated to 135 degrees C, but for only 2 seconds. So that's the regime that they use. And with regard, and I've been feeling very bad about our high school student wanting to know about acid-base balance, if you go to the Twitter homepage.
So the pH balance in your blood.
Yep. Yeah, and this nursing student has given a link. So go to my Dr. Carl.
Have you retweeted that link?
Do you know how to retweet it?
I'll tell you. We've got Luke calling in from Newcastle. Hi, Luke.
How you going?
Good. What's your question?
Me and my mate Clint, we had a bit of a disagreement earlier. We're just wondering whether an aeroplane, can it take a lightning strike and blow all the electronics, or does it just pass straight through it?
What you're looking at, Dr. Luke, is a thing called a Faraday cage, F-A-R-A-D-A-Y, from one of the pioneers of electric motors, Michael Faraday, who got his knowledge while working as a bookbinder and taught himself to read and was smart, and then got picked up by a wealthy person who looked after him and gave him an education, and he invented the DC motor for us, which makes grown men and women cry when they see it in the basement of the Royal Institution. So any continuous metal object, like, say, a microwave oven or a mesh screen, depending on the frequencies, will trap, will separate what's happening from the inside to what's happening on the outside. So an aeroplane used to be made of aluminium or aluminum for our American listeners, and the lightning bolt would hit at one end and then go towards the other end and then just pass through and out of the airplane. So there are photos showing it hitting at the nose, for example, and then it continues out of the tail and down to the, towards the ground. Occasionally you can jump into the plane and do bad things. In general, you do not want lightning hitting planes, but in general, it seems to be safe, providing it's not too big. There have been bad things happening in the past, but not too many of them. Where we're heading for tricky ground now is meet with the aeroplanes that are made of composites, which are not necessarily conductive, things like carbon fiber composites. And so they're adding things into them to make them conductive, but then when they're joining one composite to another, at the joint they might not be as conductive. It seems as though they're on top of this problem, but in general it's okay for planes to get hit by lightning because it happens all the time, but they prefer to avoid it. Who gets a case of beer?
I think I'll get that one.
Oh, congratulations, Luke. Have a good weekend with it.
No,
see you later, mate.
Yeah.
John's calling in from Bond Beach. Hi, John.
Hey, guys, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
My wife and I went in yesterday for an ultrasound for the 12-week-old, and it was a very active 12-week-old, which got me thinking. I was wondering if babies, unborn babies, actually sleep.
They are floating around, Dr. Luke, and is this your first baby?
It is, yeah. It's
John. So at 20 weeks, you and your wife should be able to feel it kicking on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And I always get tears in my eyes thinking of the first time I felt that. It's a wonderful moment.
Yeah.
Hey, there's a live human. Now, the answer is I don't know, but I'll just take you through it. When babies are born, they sleep a lot, and then gradually they drop down to adult sleeping times of, you know, 8 hours a night by the time they hit puberty. And then it increases again. What happens in the uterus? I'm guessing, without any real knowledge, that they spend a lot of time sleeping because they're doing a lot of growing and they need a lot of growth hormone, and growth hormone is related to sleeping, but I'm not sure of that. I do know that they tend to wake up when the ultrasound blasts them, and maybe they in some way can respond to this auditory beam of 1 to 5 million hertz, and they'll wave at you and they'll suck their thumb. I do not know for sure how much time they spend asleep, and hopefully somebody will be able to give us an answer to that on Twitter.
All right, we'll see if we can find out for you before the hour's out. Thanks, John.
Thanks, guys.
See you later, mate. Holly's calling in from Yarrawonga. Hi, Holly.
Hi, Dr. Holly. Welcome to the show.
You're on the air, Holly. I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yarrawonga, it sounds like it belongs in a song.
Yarrawonga in Victoria. Yeah. But Holly has left the building, so we're going to have to leave Holly, see if we can find her again, and check out if Bess... Oh, hi, Bess.
Hi.
Hi, good. That's a bad phone line. What's your question for Dr. Carl?
Well, I was actually wondering, I was going to ask you about colloidal silver. We've got a friend that just uses it all the time and for everything. Like, he puts it in his fish tank when his fish gets sick and swears black and blue that it always works. And I was just wondering how it works and if it really does.
I don't know the exact mechanism by which it works, but it definitely works. It's been known in history for a long, long time. The Romans used silver because it is bioactive, or rather the silver iron, Ag+, but I don't really know why. It was well known that the Indian kings and princes, whenever they travelled and are worried about water, would carry their water with them in large silver vessels. Silver is present in wound dressings because it tends to keep the bacteria down. It's not a bactericidal. In other words, it doesn't kill the bacteria, but it's a bit bacteriostatic. It stops them from increasing enormously in numbers. It was very popular until the 1940s when we had the safe, the powerful antibiotics. And there are side effects of silver. There's a tragic photo of somebody who used too much eye drops, which have got silver in them, and he thought a little bit is good, so more is better. He actually turned silver in colour, and it's irreversible. And so in America, they're worried about this to the extent that they're banning colloidal silver simply because it does have a weak, healthy effect, but it does have side effects, and people ignore the side effects and can find themselves turning silver.
Ah, so then what would you use it for? Just use it instead of antibiotics?
As on wound dressings, there are even colloidal silver particles being released by certain washing machines. So they've got an electrode of silver, and every time the washing machine goes through a cycle, it activates up the silver and releases, you know, a few nanograms of it into the water and hopefully knocks down the bacteria, because you get bacterial smell spread from your underwear into the rest of your wash. But the bacterial levels are so low that normally it doesn't matter, so I think it's more of a marketing thing rather than an effective, safe thing. So, but colloidal silver definitely works for some things, but it's fairly weak, and it does have side effects. Don't think that it doesn't. It does have side effects.
As we've learned today, everything has side effects.
Everything has side effects, even water.
Thanks for the call, Bess.
Thank you, Dr. Bess.
See you later. I think we've got time for one more from Joseph calling in from Lane Cove. Hi, Joseph.
Hi, how are you going?
Good. What's your question?
My question's just trying to find out the link between concentration and regular but not very intense marijuana use.
As Dr. Zan said, it has side effects. It has most of its side effects when taken before the brain is fully cooked.
Yeah.
And that normally happens around the age of 20 to 22 when the individual reverts back to adult sleep patterns. Suddenly they can go to sleep late at night, and suddenly they are okay with 8 hours sleep. They don't. And marijuana, any drug during that time is bad. There are studies showing that it does interfere with concentration and with memory, but in the same way that it has bad side effects, it has good side effects.
Yeah. And
I'm not arguing either way from it, because this is not the right venue for it, but it does seem to interfere with concentration, whether short-term or long-term. I haven't read the latest stuff. It does seem to have long-term effects.
And the variables as well, in terms of how much you actually intake over a lifetime or over even a short period of time. If you're smoking a lot, would obviously make an effect too, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Sure. And then there's the other factor that you should, if you go to take drugs, and everybody does, whether it's coffee or tea or alcohol, make sure you're in good condition before you take them. Don't take them because you're feeling down. You want to be healthy, and then you knock yourself down from your health status. You do not find your 100-meter sprint Olympic athletes saying, oh, I'm going to go and get drunk the night before the Olympics, or have a lot of marijuana the night before my sprint. It'll make me better. Nah, everything has a price.
Thanks for the call, Joseph.
No worries.
Thank you, Dr. Joseph.
And a reminder, too, that if you missed out on any of this morning's Science Talk Back, it is available for you on demand whenever you damn please on the podcast, www.j.net.au. We're going to chuck it up there for you in, a couple of hours' time, maybe even an hour's time, Dr. Carl. Just check back with the podcast and you can subscribe and get it delivered to you no matter where you are every single week. Dr. Carl, we'll see you same time next week.
That'll be absolutely fabulous, Dr. Zan.
Thank you.